From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today on Intersection, we're talking about meat, especially what we eat, how meat consumption is changing, and meat production in Missouri. We're also talking about consumers' growing interest in grass-fed beef. Our guests are KBIA's Harvest Public Media reporter Chris Husted, Mary Hendrickson, who is an assistant professor of rural sociology at MU, and lawyer, rancher, and author Nicolette Hahn Nyman, who is author of the books Righteous Pork Chop and Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. KBIA's Chris Husted is part of a network of agriculture reporters called Harvest Public Media. Collectively, Harvest recently reported a series on meat consumption and production in the U.S., which you can check out online at Harvest Public Media.
So the series, it's called Choice Cuts, Meat in America, and we decided as a team to break apart how the diet for meat in America has evolved. Years ago, meat, you know, I think of the Brady Bunch movie where they went to the meat counter and they would buy 50 pounds of ground beef and cook 10 of it for the 12 members of the family. Anyway, so we wanted to break apart exactly how the consumption of meat by Americans has evolved over time and also how that has influenced the industry, which is in Missouri's backyard.
How have American meat choices changed?
Americans eat hundreds of pounds of meat every year, and that's just part of the American diet. That has changed over time. It's gone down. Not a ton, but it's gone down a significant amount that it's noticeable when we look at the statistics. And a lot of that has to deal with dietary recommendations and research that's gone into how meat affects our health. So beef consumption in general has gone down, but poultry consumption is higher than ever. More Americans are eating chicken and turkey than ever before. And again, a lot of that has to deal with the dietary recommendations and the research that's come out based on the nutritional impact that red meat specifically has.
What is that research and what are those recommendations that are influencing people to maybe choose turkey or chicken instead of red meat?
I have to look at my notes here, but you know, with dietary recommendations, they began in 1980, and that's from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And essentially, it was done initially to make sure that Americans weren't having any deficiencies in their diet, so making sure they got enough iron, calcium, vitamins. That has evolved over time as research has come out in nutritional universities who have done nutritional research. A lot of the research has shown that there's been a higher risk with high meat consumption, specifically red meat, as it pertains to cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, and certain cancers. As that research has come out, the guidelines for what Americans should be eating has evolved to include more types of proteins that are not from sources of animals. So we see nuts and legumes pushed more as a source of protein because of its health benefits and because they're not tied to risks of some of these diseases that red meat specifically has been tied to. The guidelines have also reduced the portion size of protein and meat that we're supposed to be eating as Americans. It used to include the group used to be called the meat group as the dietary guidelines, but today it's actually called the protein group because it isn't just meat. The guidelines do push for more seafood and more poultry, but also, as I mentioned, an increase in legumes and nuts as a source. Just as some numbers here, in 2010, the dietary guidelines recommended Americans eat about 0.2 pounds of meat per day. I think it's around 3 to 6 ounces. But most Americans were averaging about 0.36 pounds of meat per day. And that's the Wall Street Journal did some analysis of the Ag Department data. So Americans are eating more meat than is recommended. American beef consumption has gone down, and a lot of that has to do with the dietary guidelines. But a lot of it also has to do with pretty successful marketing by certain groups that are pushing organic, for instance, or poultry, for instance. they've been pretty successful trying to highlight that they have better health benefits, and they're not tied to some of these risks that red meat is associated with. That being said, we've also seen certain beef take off, though, and these are choice cuts of beef. We see Angus as a successful type of meat that's Americans are buying. But we're also seeing, and the numbers are spotty on this, but we're seeing increased interest in grass-fed beef. The other side of what we'll see beef-wise, especially from Missouri producers, is in countries like China and India, there's a growing middle class, and the demand for beef is increasing over there extremely. So we're going to see a lot of demand for exports of Missouri beef going up. So, and as that middle class continues to grow in those countries, we might also see more interest in grass-fed beef growing there. But for right now, the interest is generally just for beef from those countries. But as we see in America, as the consumer becomes more educated, as the shopper wants to know how their beef was raised, if we start seeing that in the next 10, 15 years or so in countries like China and India, we will also see Missouri producers trying to meet that demand as well. So even though consumption of beef is on the decline in the U.S., it is still growing globally. So there is a demand to meet there for our Missouri producers.
That was KBIA's agriculture reporter Chris Husted talking about a recent reporting project by Harvest Public Media. Now we're going to hear from MU Assistant Professor of Rural Sociology Mary Hendrickson about what meat means in Missouri.
Meat's a big deal, real big deal. And that has to do with we have one of the larger cattle herds in the country here in Missouri. Now, most of those cattle aren't finished out here, but the calves are born here in Missouri. So we have one of the larger cattle herds, and we're really well positioned to raise cattle in Missouri. Up across the north central part of the state, we have land that is much better utilized for pasture production. It's a good thing for the soil. You don't get as much erosion with well-managed pasture. It can be really good for climate change because it can soil that is covered year in, year out with green grass, sequesters a lot of carbon. So there's a lot of good things about beef production here in the state of Missouri. We also, of course, have quite a significant poultry industry. We have both turkeys over by California. Missouri is a big area. California has a Cargill processing plant. We also have a lot of poultry production down in the southern part of the state, southwest, and also southeast. And hogs. How could I forget pork? We have pretty significant pork production in the state of Missouri. Now, the structure of the industry has changed quite a bit in the last 20 years. We used to have a lot of dispersed pork producers, and that's been consolidated into much larger farms now.
So really, chicken, beef, and pork are the three
and
main
turkey.
Meats. And turkey. And they're all coming together here in Missouri.
That's right. That's correct. And so we're a big meat producer, and animal agriculture is pretty important to the state of Missouri.
And how has that changed across those beef, chicken, turkey, and pork industries, say, over the last 10 years?
Well, the pork industry, if you look at the last 20 years, the pork industry has changed quite a bit. I grew up raising pigs in the state of Nebraska, and it was a small operation. We had about what we would call 100 sows farrow to finish. That meant we raised the pigs on the farm from the time they were born until they went to market, and that was about 2,500 pigs a year. We don't see those kinds of farms very much anymore. What we see is larger scale, 600 to 1,000 sow units that might only raise pigs for a couple of weeks. Then they're sold out to grow out houses, and those are concentrated. So we see areas of the state that have pretty concentrated operations in the pork arena that are operating that are sometimes under contract. So we have a Smithfield plant in the north central part of the state, Smithfield is now owned by the Chinese firm, and I don't know how to pronounce it, so I'm not going to say it right now. But a lot of our pork then is going internationally. Now, the beef cattle industry, we still have a very dispersed kind of industry in the state. So we have a lot of small producers who may run 20 or 30 head of cattle, and then they sell those calves at weaning time, and they go into a different system. But we also have a lot of people who finish cattle out on feedlots, and then we're also a big leader in integrated pasture management or integrated grazing, and that rotational grazing, and that has been a big boon to the state for both dairy production and cattle production.
And what is integrated grazing?
So it's a way to get more productivity out of your pastures by managing them very intensively. So that means that you keep animals on a smaller space for a very short period of time and move them on a regular rotation. A lot of these guys are moving them every day. Sometimes people move two or three times a week, but they're really moving their animals from pasture to pasture. And the cattle love it. They get new grasses to eat. They're not reduced to having to clean up anything. And it's a way, you know, there is some research that shows about these pastures can be 30% more productive by grazing this way. But it's management intensive. So farmers have to take some time and spend some time out there. It's a little bit harder deal than just letting your cattle out to run.
And is this a recent change in
I would
farming?
Say in the last 10 to 20 years, Missouri has really been a leader in this arena. It started a lot with the Forage Systems Research Center, one of our outlying farms at the University of Missouri. They did a lot of research, but they did the research in conjunction with farmers, and that was really cool. They worked a lot with the Green Hills Farm Project. There was this group of farmers that were interested in trying to do things differently, and they're like, here's our questions. And the researchers are like, oh, that's a good idea. Let's try that. Let's test it out. Well, that didn't work so well, or this works better. So people like Fred Martz and Jim Garish really helped establish the Missouri as a spot for this. We've also done a lot of research on dairy grazing for dairies. We've attracted a lot of international attention with our grazing for dairies, including establishing some very large grass-based dairying by some New Zealand farmers. So grass is one of our big resources here in the state, and it's really important, and it's really good for meat production. And I always have to remind people, there's a lot of people that say, well, we need to get rid of those cattle and start growing vegetables. Well, the land we're grazing, it's not going to work for vegetables. It's just not. It's not the best soil. We have water issues. And keeping that land in grass is probably one of the best things we can do environmentally for our state.
And are there a lot of grass-fed cattle, exclusively grass-fed in Missouri?
Well, there are. Now, we have to talk a little bit about what we mean by grass-fed, okay? So since the mid-20th century, we've had this idea that we'd like to finish cattle out on corn. And a lot of us in the United States have kind of developed a taste for that kind of beef, and we really enjoy it. You eat a nice big juicy steak with a lot of fat in it. People really enjoy that. Now, when you go to grass finishing, it requires different methods on the part of the farmer, the rancher. It also requires different ideas on the part of the consumer. So it has a different taste. You have to cook it in a different manner. Often grass-fed beef won't have as much marbling in it, as much fat going through the muscles of the meat. And because of that, you cannot cook it quite the same way you barbecue or you grill or you do things like this. You have to cook it long and slow. And chefs that have adopted that, they love it. They think it's great. Now, there are a lot of people argue about the environmental complications of beef, right? We're going to have a speaker here in the next few weeks who's going to talk a lot about that. You know, cattle are really blamed for a lot of climate change, greenhouse gases problems, methane. They burp. That's what people say, right? But on the other hand, if we're keeping grass on these places that would be bare part of the year because if it would be in row crop production instead of grass, we're keeping grass and we're keeping deep-rooted grasses on that soil. It's sequestering carbon. It's acting as buffer, so you don't get nearly as much soil erosion into creeks. You don't get the runoff from cropland. So there's a lot of good things that can be said about that kind of procedure for cattle production. Now, broilers and turkeys, those are pretty large scale here in this state. And we are seeing a lot more people interested in locally produced poultry. I tell you what, we can't find processors to save our souls. These poor folks that are raising a lot of larger flocks out on grass, it's really difficult for them to find that extra step between the producer and the consumer, which is the person who will process those chickens. We go immediately from a very small scale to a very large scale, and there's nothing in between.
And do you think there are more of these locally interested consumers now than there were 20 years ago, and why? What do you think
is
working on people to change their interests?
There are a ton more, because I started working on local foods in the mid-90s. So I can tell you, there's a ton more. I used to know almost all of the kinds of local food projects that were going on across the state. I have no clue now. I think that there's a lot more access. So we've developed outlets so people can access locally produced foods, especially city people who didn't have that access before. There's a big dialogue about food going on. And I'm not saying consumers are always right, because I actually think people hold some pretty strange ideas sometimes about agriculture and food. But there are, on the other hand, there's a lot of farmers who don't want to listen to the consumers. And so what I'm really interested in is the dialogue, and I want to help people understand each other and really understand what are some of the issues on the farm side and on the consumer side. And the dialogue has just exponentially exploded in this state in the last 20 years, and I think that leads to markets and changes in the way people acquire their food.
Thanks to Assistant Professor of Rural Sociology Mary Hendrickson for that look at meat in Missouri. Now, for our third interview, we're going to hear from KBIA's agriculture reporter Chris Husted again. He interviewed lawyer, rancher, and author Nicolette Hahn Nyman, who is author of the books Righteous Pork Chop and Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. We're dropping into the conversation here as Hahn Nyman talks about a 2006 report by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, which is often called the FAO. The report's called Livestock's Long Shadow.
The FAO report was really attempting to catalog sort of all of the resource implications and, you know, sort of the negative impacts of livestock worldwide. And then, you know, ironically, this is a report that's often cited by vegans, but that was really not the position of the authors at all. They were actually arguing that we should be doing more intensive confinement of especially pork and poultry, and less of the ruminants, you know, the grazing animals. You know, fewer animals in the field and more animals in big confinement buildings. So it's a very ironic aspect of that report, you know, what its recommendations were and its purposes and how it's actually used out in the public. But yes, I think that report, when it comes to the climate change in particular, really kicked things off. It stated that it concluded that all livestock globally contributed 18% of the global warming emissions for the globe. That's very different than the national figure, so that's an important distinction. The 18% figure began to be used very widely, very quickly, and it's, as far as I'm concerned, it has quite a few problems to it, which I kind of dissect a little bit in defending beef.
Right. One of them I wanted to talk to you about is deforestation and that link.
Right. Right.
That has, you know, a global impact. Massively,
yep.
But not nationally.
Yeah. And in fact, there are a couple of – so about 38% of that total 18% figure was actually due to deforestation in the developing world, specifically Brazil, Indonesia, Sudan, and a few other countries, but those are the main ones. And to me, there are many problems in including that in the 18% figure. So the first one, you know, you just – as you just suggested in your question, when you're talking about in the United States, and you're talking to domestic beef consumers, it is truly disingenuous to connect that deforestation to them for two reasons. First of all, there is very little beef in the United States that's imported. This is actually something we do domestically. You know, we're a big beef producer. We're a big beef consumer. The vast majority of what Americans are consuming was actually from the United States. Secondly, of that small amount, it's less than 20% that's imported, over 80% of that is from three countries, which are basically Canada, Mexico, and Australia. So you're left with a tiny percent, kind of the maximum that could be of U.S. beef supply that could be coming from these deforesting areas of the world would be 2%. But that's the maximum. So that ignores other countries that we get beef from that are not deforesting. And in the U.S., so the other key piece, first of all, we're not eating meat from those sources. So that's a really important point. Then in the U.S., deforestation is simply not happening at all, and it is definitely not happening with respect to the beef industry. We're actually, if you look at the statistics over historically, the United States is actually reforesting right now. We have more forested acreages, and especially that's happening like in the northeastern part of the United States and so forth. There are areas where there's a lot more reforestation happening. But some of that's from abandoned farmland and lots of different reasons as it's happening, but we're actually increasing the number of acres in the U.S. of forest. So it's really just truly misleading and inaccurate to tell people that their hamburger is connected to deforestation. I actually don't think that any farmers anywhere in the world should be blamed for some bad land use policies that are taking place in certain parts of the developing world. But if you're going to do it at all, you certainly shouldn't be doing it when you're talking to American audiences.
Are there certain connections to climate change or global warming that we should be aware of that are happening maybe not as massively as an 18% impact, but certain things that we do need to keep an eye on with the cattle industry?
Well, absolutely. I mean, globally, I think, first of all, the FAO issued another report in 2013, which updated its 18% figure, and they reduced it down to 14%. So I think that's, probably a little bit more accurate of a figure, except for they still include deforestation in it, which I disagree with. But that's for the, I'm willing to say that it's somewhere in that neighborhood for the global figure. But for various reasons, the United States figure is significantly lower. And I can get into as much detail about that as you want me to, but it is quite a bit lower in the U.S. And domestically, the federal United States Environmental Protection Agency has quantified all of agriculture's contribution to global warming to be between 8-10%. And they say that all ruminants, so the dairy cattle, the beef cattle, the domesticated bison, the goats, and the sheep, all added together is about 2% of the global warming emissions in the United States. So again, people are continually confusing the figures that are global and those that are national, and those are really important distinctions.
Are there certain little areas that still need improvement in the U.S., even though we are?
Oh yes, I'm sorry, I was getting there. And so, actually, yes, 2% is not the enormous figure that you sometimes hear people throwing around, but it's an important number. And what I talk about in defending beef in some detail is that there are lots of reasons to believe that cattle emissions can be brought down. There's incredible research happening all over the world looking into methane emissions for cattle. Most of that 2% is from methane emissions, especially enteric emissions from ruminants. So it's really a question of how do we reduce those emissions? And there's very good research that's looking at how you increase carbon sequestration from grazing animals. And actually, there's wonderful demonstrations of it happening all over the world. So a lot of carbon is being taken out of the atmosphere and being put into the soils with the help of grazing animals. It's also true, and I actually didn't talk about it in Defending Beef because at the time I hadn't seen very much research on it and I wasn't sure it was good enough to include it. But I've looked at it more since then, and I believe it's actually pretty solid. And that is that the methane itself may be largely broken down by bacteria in the soil, which are either called methanotrophs or methane oxidizing bacteria, MOBs, MOBs, just because you really needed another acronym. And there's really interesting research on that in Australia and in India and, you know, various parts of the world that are basically showing that when you have intact ecosystems, a lot of the methane coming out of those is actually dealt with by the ecosystem itself. It's all about balance, you know. And some of the research in Australia actually shows that the methane oxidizing bacteria in a well-managed grazing operation will actually totally oxidize the methane coming from the cattle, which means that none of it gets up into the atmosphere. So that's incredibly important research that's just kind of in its infancy, but there's quite a bit of it. I mean, it's not just one guy saying this or something. There are a number of studies on this. And so there are many unanswered questions, and there's lots of good research looking at basically how do we sequester more carbon? How do we break down the bacteria, break down the methane with the bacteria? How can we foster that? The presence of dung beetles, for example, has been found to be really important in that process. And so, for example, just one possible line of inquiry could be, what do we do to foster the population of dung beetles? And one thing that's being looked at is reducing the use of dewormers, you know, anti-parasite type medications that you give to cattle in order to help foster the populations of dung beetles, because it's being shown, hey, those really help with reducing methane. So there's a lot of work going on this. And so I think that even that, you know, 2% that we have nationally and that, you know, somewhere it's probably 9% globally that are connected to the ruminants, I think that could be addressed.
Thanks to KBIA's Chris Husted and author and rancher Nicolette Han Nyman, who is author of the books Righteous Pork Chop and Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. And thank you for spending your time with us here at Intersection, conversations with our community. I want to thank our producers, Katie Eisterhold and Eileen Lee, and our community outreach team of Helen Tien and Kara Tabor. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection, right here on KBIA 91.3 FM.